Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative. It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustina. Joining us this week is Corinne Carey. We've met her before. She's the Senior Campaign Director of Compassion and Choices for New York and New Jersey. She's led the lobbying effort for many years. This the 10th year, a full decade, trying to pass medical aid and dying legislation in New York. It did pass in New Jersey. That's a victory. We've learned now that Delaware has passed this initiative. However, the fight is continuing in New York. It has passed the Assembly. It has not yet passed the Senate. Corinne Carey, welcome back to the Capital Connection.
Thank you so much for having me.
Big, important issue. Again, if you follow the legislature, there are so many people like Corinne that have been battling issues for years and years and years. And this may just pay off this session, right? Because as I heard from Liz Krueger last week on this program, she's a co-sponsor, and she says she's the most optimistic she's ever been. She believes, she said, and I have it here, we have the votes.
Yeah, I mean, Liz is not only a co-sponsor, but she's a senior member of the Democratic Conference in the legislature. And so I was very gratified to hear her confirm what we believe as well, that the votes are there to pass this bill.
So, Corinne Carey, let's talk just for a second about the victory in Delaware. What happened there that put you over the top?
I think it was the same as it's been in many states. It's a persistent dialogue with lawmakers about a really difficult issue. You know, obviously, there are lawmakers who get it immediately, and it's an issue of autonomy. It's an issue of control over our own health care at arguably one of the most important times in our lives. But for some people, it's very difficult to talk about death and dying. And so it takes a long time to break down those barriers. And you have to keep an open mind with people who may not want to talk about this or be skeptical or be opposed. Because in the end, it's going to be those people who get you to the finish line. And so we've been very patient across the country, very understanding of the difficult nature of these conversations. And I think that's what pays off.
Yeah. And it's been shown through these 10 years that you've been listening and paying attention to the opposition and what their concerns are. Some are just making sure that this is the independent choice of the person and that it's, you know, signed off by medical professionals, that the family can't cause any harm in this way. And so what you have been doing is turning minds toward the idea that you've put enough protections in place in this legislation so that if someone is a fatal disease, they're going to be in long-term pain, they have a right to say, no, I'm going to go out on my own terms.
Yeah, you know, this is not my first legislative campaign.
No.
And so I am very familiar with what the levers of power are and how you can get a bill passed in a state as complicated as New York. And I knew when we started this campaign that it wouldn't be polling, it wouldn't be money, it wouldn't be donations or high-powered lobbyists that would get this bill to the finish line. It's about these one-on-one conversations with people and really, as you said, changing hearts and minds. And I think it's a combination of being responsive to the concerns that opponents and skeptics had over the past decade, but also being there when lawmakers themselves had personal experiences with death and dying that opened their minds to meeting with us. I remember one Mother's Day several years ago, we had a group of mothers who had lost children, adult children to terminal illness, and children who'd lost their mothers to terminal illness. And we were lobbying. We were trying to get as many lawmakers on board as possible. And we asked Reverend Al Taylor to meet with us. And in the past, he had sort of been, you know, polite and read our materials, but made it very clear that as a faith leader, as a man of faith himself, he couldn't support this bill. But he sat down and met with those moms. And halfway through the meeting, he revealed that he had lost his own father. And that experience opened his heart and his mind. And by the end of the meeting, he became one of our biggest champions for this bill. It's moments like that that we've been ready for in this campaign. We don't want to see anyone lose a family member, but death is inevitable. It's a part of life. And we knew that within the course of these 10 years, people would lose loved ones.
I'm speaking with Corinne Carey, Senior Campaign Director of Compassion and Choices for New York and New Jersey. I'm David Gustina. You're listening to The Capital Connection, and you said something about the good reverend, that he read the materials. You know, and I've talked to many lawmakers on this program, and when I get to this subject, it's clear when they haven't read the materials, because they tend to come in with their preconception of what this is, and they don't go any further. They've established where they're going to be, and they're not going to listen or read or study anything. So that's a big problem you have to overcome, isn't it?
Oh, it surely is. I mean, even watching the assembly debate on this bill, some of the people who spoke the most forcefully about this issue never met with our advocates.
Yeah.
They wouldn't meet with constituents. They wouldn't meet with members of the medical society. They wouldn't meet with anyone. And so what they said on the floor was a complete misunderstanding of what this issue is. And those comments have been amplified by the opposition. I'll tell you, I appreciate so much meeting with lawmakers who've taken the time to read the bill, to read the opposition, read the support, ask me questions, and then at the end of that meeting say, "I'm sorry, I understand what you're trying to do, but I can't be with you on this." I respect that so much.
Absolutely.
And I just hope that lawmakers take that kind of thing to heart. In order to represent your constituents well, you need to know what you're voting on, not just have some conception of what you're voting on.
Yeah. And when we live in an age where the party sort of directs their members what to do, that does not lend to independent thought and reading the materials. And it's interesting because I'm betting that even some of these arguments on the floor were wrong, that you had already dealt with their concerns in the actual legislation they were talking about.
That's absolutely true. I can't tell you how often I've had to remind lawmakers that the bill actually requires everyone to participate of their own free will. No patient, no doctor, no pharmacist, no hospice nurse, if they don't believe in this, has to participate in medical aid in dying once the bill passes.
I think the language is important as well, and we've gotten some comments when the phrase physician-assisted suicide is used. Now, we know that especially religious concerns about the issue of suicide, and it's more complex than that. Yes, someone technically may be setting the plan in place to take their own life, but they're doing it for a different reason than, "I don't like this world, I don't like myself, I'm depressed." It's for a different reason. So physician-assisted suicide, that phrasing doesn't really capture what this legislation is about.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, that's why we stay away from that term. That's why many medical organizations have rejected using that term, because it's inflammatory, it's incendiary. You think about suicide and you want to get as far away from enabling that as possible. But we're talking about terminally ill people who would like nothing more than to live. And no amount of treatment, no amount of therapy or medication or innovations will save their lives and keep them alive. They want to forestall the suffering. They want to stop the suffering. And, you know, I think it's important to know that another advocacy term is death with dignity. We don't use that for this bill either. We talk about it as medical aid in dying because that's what it is. Death with dignity is an advocacy term. Suicide is an advocacy term used by the opponents. Let's talk about what this is. And it's medical aid in dying. It's putting the power of how one's own life ends in the hands of the person who deserves it the most, the dying person.
Yeah, and there's an argument to be made that people will find ways to do it without support from the state, and that codifying it, having rules, making a plan so that it goes without a hitch is much better than allowing people to go out and do it on their own.
You're right, David, and it happens now. And it's not only making sure that it happens without a hitch, and I've certainly heard horrible stories about when it does go with a hitch, so to speak. But more importantly, when someone takes their own life by suicide, they often do so using violent means. And that is traumatizing for the family, the extended family, generations ahead, the community, EMS workers, and healthcare providers. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, this is an incredible suicide prevention measure for that percentage of people who take matters into their own hands when their suffering becomes too great.
One of the other areas of this is with doctors. You know, they're committed to preserving life and saving people from death. And you could see where that might counteract with the idea of letting someone go. But if you're trying to keep people from pain, that's the other factor, isn't it?
Yeah, you know,
and suffering.
I think one of the things you hear, you know, maybe in your own lives or in a movie, is when a doctor is standing before someone who's terminally ill and they say, "There's nothing more that I can do for you." That's never true.
No.
There are many doctors who now understand that in addition to helping people become well and curing people, another duty is to do no harm. And some people say that that argument should be used to defeat medical aid in dying because obviously that's harm. But many doctors now understand that when someone is suffering interminably and there's nothing that can be done more to alleviate their suffering, withholding something that could give them peace is actively doing harm. And that's why I think the vast majority of doctors in New York support this, the New York State Academy of Family Physicians, the Medical Society of the State of New York. It's that recognition that doctors can always walk with a patient to the very end of their lives and make sure that it's not an end-of-life experience that's filled with suffering and despair.
So true. And Corinne Curry, let me add this, because I had a personal experience. My cousin, years ago now, over a decade or more, lost his wife at 29 to fourth-stage breast cancer. And, you know, she suffered up until the end. And when she passed, and you'll hear this a lot with people who suffer through cancer and die, that's what gave relief to her husband, my cousin Jim, when she was no longer in pain. So what you're doing, in a sense, by doing this, is you're not only relieving the person who has pain and is suffering, but you're alleviating the pain for the loved ones around them that have to witness this thing happen.
That's right. It's so complicated. When someone loses someone who's suffered, the grief reaction of feeling both at a loss for someone that you loved and also relieved that
total
they're gone
relief
is so complicated. And holding both of those feelings at the same time is sometimes devastating to people, especially when they've sat at the bedside unable to help. And I think that what we've seen with medical aid in dying in states that authorize it, and it's now available to close to a quarter of American adults in this country with Delaware's recent approval, what we've seen is that the grieving process, it's no less hard to lose someone, but the last memories of your loved one aren't of excruciating pain. And that is an incredible blessing for people.
And it puts the power in the hands of the person whose life is at stake.
Right. And that person can orchestrate what the end of their life experience looks like. We've seen really beautiful manifestations of this in California and in other states where people are having end-of-life celebrations.
Yeah.
They're gathering the people that mean the most around them and taking the medication and passing away peacefully with those who mattered the most, instead of, you know, dying alone in a hospital room while someone runs out to try to get the doctor to increase the pain medication. We've heard so many stories about people who couldn't be at the bedside, you know, because they just didn't know when it was going to happen.
Yeah, I was in a hospital recently, not for myself, but to visit someone, and there was a terminal patient in the next room, and all they were doing was calling out to their mother over and over and over again, and it was such a helpless feeling, you know. Corinne Curry, Senior Campaign Director of Compassion and Choices for New York and New Jersey. Let's talk a little bit more specifically about the legislation. I remember last year you were saying we're gearing up, we're going to expand it, we're going to push hard in 2024. Let's talk about that 2024 into 2025 campaign and what is in this final version of the legislation.
The legislation models Oregon's first law ever in this country that was passed in 1994. And very simply, medical aid in dying allows a terminally ill person to request from their doctor a prescription for medication that they can take at a time of their choosing, so long as they can self-ingest that medication and die peacefully. The illness that someone has to be incurable and irreversible, not because if someone can't afford the treatment or if someone can't access it, literally incurable and irreversible, even if they had the means to cure it.
Yeah, it's not 50% chance, not 60%, totally incurable.
Absolutely. And the person has to be given a prognosis of 6 months or less. There needs to be an attending physician to whom the person makes an oral request and a written request, and then a consulting physician. Both of those physicians have to agree that the person has mental capacity, has a terminal illness, and has a six-month prognosis.
So it's like a first and second opinion.
It's true. And both of them have to do a mental health screening. And if either doctor has concerns about that person's mental health capacity, they have to refer that person to a mental health professional. And no prescription can be written unless and until that professional signs off on the mental capacity.
Those are high bars. I mean, you know, because you can imagine that someone knowing they're going to die are going to have a little bit of a mental health problem to begin with and wrestling with that. So, you know, you've got to really work with the person to figure out where they are.
Absolutely. And there's a big difference between clinical depression that can be treated
right.
and situational depression.
Yeah.
And it is the doctor's role to determine whether that depression rises to the level where it clouds the person's judgment and is interfering with their ability to make a fully informed decision.
Yeah. So then they have to self-administer, which takes the worry about a greedy son-in-law, you know, wants to get rid of his mother-in-law to get an inheritance or something.
Right. Sooner than
yeah.
they might.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact is these folks are dying,
yep.
and that's what I think people need to remember. I also want to dispel, you know, kind of a myth that people think it's a pill. It's not. It's a medication protocol, and that protocol is more of an assurance that the person is acting of their own free will because they have to take preparatory medication 45 minutes to an hour before they take the final medication. And at any point in the process, the person can change their minds. I think that's a really important piece of this bill.
Are they asked if they want to change their mind, or it's just up to them to say that?
It's up to them. I mean, once the doctor goes through all of the steps of approving someone, then it's in the patient's hands. And anything else would pressure the patient to act on a timetable that may not be their own. And that's another important thing to understand is that, look, when we send people home on hospice care, there's no continual monitoring of that. You know, we send them home with a pack of medication that they can take to relieve their suffering. And they're trusted, and their families are trusted to know how to administer that medication. It's important to trust dying people and their families to take care of one another. And that's a key part of this bill as well.
Where's Governor Kathy Hochul on this?
The governor has not made a public statement about this bill. She has repeatedly said that she will wait to see when the legislature delivers her the bill. And I've worked with the governor in the past. We worked on the women's equality agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Was that several decades ago? Feels like
it's a while ago now.
And I feel like her heart will be there. I think she understands the suffering that people have to endure at the end of life. And I think that she listens to trusted doctors who have experience in this area. And we certainly hope that she's listening to the voices of the many, many terminally ill people and their family members across the state who are calling on her to support and sign this bill.
Corinne Carey, are you, when you make the arguments in New York, are you bringing in folks from the other states that have it to say, hey, it's working in our state?
Somewhat. I mean, I find that us New Yorkers, we
don't care.
Well, there's
we
a certain
do it
degree
better.
Of exceptionalism here.
Yeah.
And I'm a little guilty of that myself. But what we do have in New York is we've had families whose loved ones have used medical aid in dying in other states.
Yeah.
And now we have a New Yorker whose loved one has used the law in every single state where medical aid in dying is legal. And they have come to the Capitol to testify. They've shared their stories with newspapers and with lawmakers. And it's tremendously effective for lawmakers to hear firsthand from a family member how this works. The other advantage we have is that the New York State Bar Association did a deep dive into medical aid in dying. They convened a task force and they invited experts from across the country.
Great.
On both sides of this issue, opponents and supporters, and unanimously, that task force recommended that New York should pass the Medical Aid in Dying Act, and then the full House of Delegates of the Bar Association followed.
That was a really important discussion to have both audiences in the room to work that out.
Absolutely. The League of Women Voters did the same thing. They held forums across the state for over a year to determine what their position would be.
So I can feel the tension in the air, right? You're just waiting. You're hoping beyond all hope that this comes through. If there's one single argument that's been the biggest block to this legislation, what is it?
I think it is the feeling that the state shouldn't, maybe give up on improving hospice and palliative care. And New York ranks absolute last among all states in terms of appropriate access to hospice and palliative care.
Well, there's that exceptionalism right there.
Yeah. And so, there are lawmakers who say, why don't we put all of our energy into improving hospice and palliative care? And what has become so clear to us in advocating for expanded end-of-life choices across the country is that hospice and palliative care and access to those services actually improves when you pass a medical aid in dying law. So if we want to make end-of-life care better for everyone, no matter what choice they want to make at the end of their lives, we need to open up this conversation. We need to allow physicians and their patients to have open and honest conversations about what dying people fear the most at the end of their lives. And doctors will refer people for hospice and palliative care. It's required under the bill. And doctors want to see those services work for people. And so if we want to improve that, let's pass this option. Let's open up the conversation and make sure that we're addressing everyone's needs at the end of life.
Seems to me, if we're an exceptional state, we want all options on the table. We certainly want to vet them. We want to make sure that they're safe and that they work. But we should be expanding and improving palliative care. We should be providing options for end of life. We should be doing all of it.
Right. And we shouldn't be having to look over the border in New Jersey and Vermont and now Delaware, look to California and say they're doing it better than we are. Why would we want that?
Well, Corinne Carey, the argument for it is now on the table. You have to now make your best argument to New Yorkers and any legislators that are listening right now that may be on the fence.
Well, there's an opinion piece in the Empire Report from Dr. Jeremy Bowl, who was the chief clinical officer at Mount Sinai. He's now retired after getting a diagnosis of ALS. And one of the things that he talks so eloquently about is the fact that as someone who has a certain degree of privilege, he can choose to travel to another state that has medical aid in dying. And when he realized that, his life opened up and became better. He was despondent after getting the ALS diagnosis. But once he realized that he could wrest back some control over this illness and die the way that he wanted to, surrounded by the people he loved in another state, he said it gave him a new lease on life. In fact, I think the title of the piece is, "I'm a Doctor with ALS and Medical Aid in Dying Helped Me to Live."
It's so poignant, what you just said, because having control, not feeling helpless, is what can help the end of your life go the way you want it.
Right. At the end of the day, it's not about death at all. It's about life. It's about how we live the last days, the last hours, the last moments of our lives. And they should be as beautiful as the beginning.
You know, it's funny because you talk about, I go back to the cancer example again, because it always comes down to this, quantity or quality? Do you want the maximum number of days and then spend 2/3 of those remaining days in pain and suffering? Or do you want quality up to a point where you can make a decision?
That's right. And there are studies out there that show that when someone has, exhausted their opportunity for curative treatment and they enroll in hospice and they start receiving palliative care, that sometimes that does extend life.
They send them home.
They do. And not only does the quality of their life improve, but sometimes even the quantity.
Yeah. It's been a long 10 years fighting. I know you're passionate about this. I know you care about this issue so very much, and so many of us do. So I can't wish you but the best of luck and success in this. She is Corinne Carey, Senior Campaign Director of Compassion and Choices for New York and New Jersey. And we may just yet have a medical aid in dying law passed in New York. Keep paying attention, folks, and you'll know soon enough it's on the cusp of happening or not. Corinne Carey, thank you so much for being with us. And depending on how this goes, we may have you back.
Thanks, David. There's a week left, which, as people who are familiar with Albany know, is a lot of time.
Indeed. They'll be making decisions at the last minute, as usual.
Yes.
Thanks for being on the Capital Connection once again.
Thanks for having me.
Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.